what is your musical background?
Well, I kind of grew up doing more or less marching stuff when I was a young kid, but it was drum and bugle corps.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always an arranger because they couldn't publish any music for the groups. It's kind of like they'd make it up, and it wasn't like, you know, bugle calls, but it was like, you know, very complex marching, like what marching band has become.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always kind of had this real affinity for percussion and for brass. I played French horn, and you know, we'd do all kinds of shows and designs, and I kind of got into the feel of scoring to picture in the, kind of the choreographing of these things, which is really like a field ballet, you know, because it's music and movement, and you have percussion and brass and color guard and everything going around. So that was kind of my early experience. Instead of probably many of the composers kind of went straight to music school and just kept their head in there. Then it graduated to where in high school I started writing for the jazz ensemble, mm-hmm. and we started winning all kinds of festivals because my charts kind of made us stand out instead of being like the typical jazz bands that would were playing published things. And then I started going to, they had a special projects class, and they asked, you know, who wants to do a special project, and people would go around the room, and somebody would say, I want to do pottery, and somebody would say, I want to, you know, do some kind of thing, and I said, I want to go to college. So they said, okay, we'll pay for the tuition, you pay for the books, and I started taking music theory my junior year, and so by the time I got out of college, I'd already had 2 years of theory.
Okay. Now, was there anything specific that that inspired you to get into sort of scoring?
I was just at the end of my senior year in college, and my wife said, oh, there's this show. Why don't we go see this thing called Star Wars? I said, I don't want to go. It just sounds really dumb. And the little commercials they'd have on television were, you know, just kind of strange, you know, before Star Wars, there was nothing like that. And then we waited in line at the Cinerama Dome down in Seattle, and this huge line, got in and watched it, and seen, I said, that's it. I'm doing film scoring. And, you know, from that point on, it was like the spring of the, you know, my final term. So I started looking for places to go to school where I could come down to L.A., and I decided to go to the Dick Grove School and take their full-year arranging and composing thing. And so when I was in L.A., I copied for Hanna-Barbera and different places, you know, to try and pay the bills. And then I kept bothering Hoyt Curtin in the hallway between sessions and said, you know, I'm a writer, I'm a composer, give me a chance. And finally he gave me a chance, and I did like 7 years of Hanna-Barbera, and that was kind of my ticket. So I went right from college down to L.A., and then the full-year program at Dick Groves, and I was already doing, like, parts of movie of the week kind of things, and mm-hmm. and then all this Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Okay. Well, what is the first thing you do when beginning to write a score?
Every once in a while I get cards from the, you know, our letter from the writer of the story, you know, the screenwriter, and saying, wow, you brought back what they lost in the directing and the shooting of the film. Because I try to stay pure to what the architecture of the story is. And I have kind of a process of getting to know and uncover the different layers of the drama. And then, you know, if this character represents such and such, you know, in maybe an analog to it is, okay, if that is, this character is brave, maybe his instrument is the French horns. Mm. You know, those kinds of things, and make translations from what you see to the music. But once I get to know that, I'm not sitting there laboring so much on themes and motifs anymore like I used to before I started. When I was doing my earlier work, I really, really worked on that. But now when I see the picture, it seems to be the tempo that comes first. And then after the tempo, then everything else kind of clicks in.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I first became aware of your work on the series Star Trek: The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. So, how did you come to work on that program?
It was kind of interesting because I didn't try to get in on that. I was working on some other projects, and so I always have been kind of brought forward by many of the session players who enjoy playing my work. And somebody, a drummer named Steve Schaefer, had heard that they were doing this Star Trek The Next Generation. I said, oh, that's really interesting, and I didn't think much about it. And then he called me and he says, get a demo together. Harry Lewieski, who was the head of the MGM music department, was advising Robert Justman, because they had been friends for a number of years. And Robert Justman was a co-executive producer at the time, or producer. Anyways, Steve Schaefer just said, come down. There was a session for MGM, and Harry was there, and Steve Schaefer said, come in the room, here's your guy. You've got to, and so he just sat him down, and they made him play the demo. In fact, they kicked Hans Zimmer out of it was called Room L, behind, I think it was down at Sony or somewhere, Paramount. No, it was Paramount. And kicked him out of that room. He was doing Rain Man or something.
Yes.
And he left, and we played it on the big speakers, and Harry gets on the phone. I thought, oh, he doesn't like what I'm doing. He's just ignoring me. And he gets off the phone, and we stop the demo. He says, okay, you're going to go to Trailer 4 on Thursday at 1 o'clock. I go, really? So I went there, and that's how I got it.
Cool. All right. Now, were you given any guidelines for writing music within the Star Trek universe?
You know, it was really, it's such a strong franchise that they really tried to bring the essence, kind of some of the essence of the original series, because they had no idea if it was going to flop or not, you know, so they tried to, that's why they used Alexander Courage's theme, and then they bridged into what Dennis McCarthy did or what Jerry Goldsmith did, to kind of bridge these things together. So I did the first actual session. Dennis McCarthy was doing the pilot, which was the two-part thing, and I did, I think it was episode number 3, so there was this rank and file of like 20, I think they put like a choir risers of all these guys in gray suits from Paramount were sitting there breathing down our throats, you know, as we were doing this, and you know, with the first bomb, ba 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 ba. You know, once they heard that, and I kept interjecting the theme from the original series in there, and lots of Jerry Goldsmith type things, they kind of relaxed, and then after the first couple hours, they disappeared. So the pressure was on. You know, I was just a young guy at the time, at least I thought I was. You know, but it was sure aging me with all the kind of pressure that was coming down the pike. So you had kind of the Gene Roddenberry vibe and Robert Justman, and then you had kind of the new thing with Rick Berman and what direction they wanted to take the show. So I think it took a year or two for it to really stand on its own, you know, to feel like we were writing within that show.
Well, sort of also during that time, you had worked a little bit, you'd work in animation like DuckTales and Superman. What do you find are the major differences between writing music for animation as opposed to live action?
You know, I think it has to do with the composer, because I don't approach these as animation. I don't even think of, like, Family Guy as, you know, animated characters. Basically, it's being drawn, which is, you know, a subjective thing. And if somebody aims a camera, they have to say, well, I'm going to feature this aspect of that. So there is no objectivity. I mean, there's no subjectivity. It's all, I mean, objectivity, there's only subjectivity. So to me, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, animated or not. And so maybe that's what sets me in a different world than most of the animated composers, because what they'll do is they'll dumb it down. They'll say, oh, well, this is just for kids. Mm-hmm. And then they do things that are corny and things that kind of insult the intelligence. Or not, let's put it this way, they just treat it as really low level. And then you get these kind of feature animation things, you know, like I kept looking at what Jerry Goldsmith did with like Secret of NIMH, and things like that, where he just played it full on. And there was no real difference between if that had been shot live, you know, with live actors in a situation, or whether it was, you know, a little animated mice. You know, they still had a story. You know, I just try to write what I'm given and try to do it with respect for the audience. And, you know, so to me it doesn't, and I always treat animation like it's a real world. Like on DuckTales, they had hired a couple guys to start out doing this show, and they treat it like a kind of insulting. They would wink at the audience kind of with the music, you know, kind of like a corny cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I came in, I said, look, Huey, Dewey, and Louie and Uncle Scrooge are like Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, they're really on an adventure. And I'm going to score this because when a kid, a 9-year-old or 10-year-old kid or 11-year-old kid, pretends, they don't pretend, they don't go, this is stupid. They go, look, I'm really a pirate, or I'm really on an adventure. So you have to play that part of it serious. So mm-hmm. I treated Duckburg as a real place, and all the things they did as real. Tried not to have too much cutesy stuff and let the ducks be cute. I mean, you're looking at it, if I played that stupid and then the ducks are stupid, then it would really be double stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But what made it really charming was that here is these kind of animated characters trying to be in a real world.
Mm-hmm.
So I just tried to build a whole real world in everything that I wrote.
Mm-hmm. So are you bringing anything like a Carl Stalling, or even a, like you mentioned, Hoyt Curtin? Are you bringing any of that to the table as well?
You know, I think we all pick up influences, and certainly, you know, Hoyt was a big influence on me. It, not so much musically, but more in time and how to grind out a lot of music in a short amount of time. He taught me a lot of things about production things and cranking it out because he had so many shows. Carl Stalling is probably one of the geniuses of the 20th century as far as I'm concerned, and his music stands very tall. But the thing is, he wrote that before they would animate it. He would get kind of the script, and then he'd take the songs and things and map them all out, like choreograph them
mm-hmm.
to click. So it wasn't like the animators went off and made those Bugs Bunny cartoons and then, you know, suddenly Stalling was fitting everything perfectly. It was the other way around. In fact, what I've read about Stalling is that they actually hated him because it forced the animators to be constrained by him. So we sort of have the opposite thing in that unless I'm doing a song ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, which we do many times, we have to do these big Broadway production numbers, I have to fit my music to their animation and try to make it work, and it's real difficult. So Stalling is a great teacher to anybody that watches it for timing, for transparency, for orchestrational clarity, and just for the humor of the whole thing, you know, the wit
mm-hmm.
of the whole thing is just off the scale, you know. So I really go back, and we had a show for American Dad this last season where I was able to really get in and do a whole bunch of Carl Stalling things, and the producers kind of go, as they were listening to it back, the rough version, they go, what is that? What the heck is that? Because it was so radical to them. I said, well, that's Carl Stalling. They go, well, who's that? I said, Carl Stalling, you know, he's, you know, all the Warner Brothers cartoons. They go, what? And they kept thinking, man, this is the coolest thing that ever happened. They were just all of a sudden in a different dimension.
Well, now you also worked on the Superman animated series in the 80s as well. You also had a chance to work with John Williams' theme. Were you able to sort of have some fun with it?
You know, it's funny because I did that so long ago, and then when they put together this reissue, this big compilation of Superman, I actually kind of listened to it again, and
mm-hmm.
I was kind of surprised at how well I did because I was in the midst of four different series, and it was kind of a blur to me in my memory. I think what it was is I was able to fuse the John Williams with kind of what I was doing with Star Trek, where sometimes we'd have sequencing lines going with electronics, and then we'd have the orchestra. So it was kind of fusional thing. And so I would take the the John Williams ideas. I couldn't use his Lex Luthor theme, but I would do something like it. I couldn't use the Daily Planet theme that he had. So I kind of, I've made a career out of not being sued. You know, I know how to do it in such a way that if you brought it before a magistrate, he would say, no, this is, you know, Ron knows what, you know, he's not impinging on someone else's copyright. And so, but still playing the spirit of it. Yeah, it was fun. It was because, see, like when I said I came down, I was inspired by Star Wars to come down.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, was like an amazing kind of a touchstone for me to be able to kind of walk in his footsteps a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Like we mentioned, your the music for the animated Superman is actually in a box set. Did you have any involvement with that, or was it just sort of you said it's your music, you know, sign the CDs and have a nice day kind of thing?
Well, you know, I pulled out the master tapes and let them go through them, and at first they were just going to do, you know, five or six things, and they actually then finally I think they took every cue off of three big reels or four reels of masters that I had, and then they remastered them, and so I was able to listen to them, and they would edit suites, so it wasn't just here's a little cue for, you know, 9 seconds, and here's a, they kind of fused them into these suites that was really kind of stunning. I was kind of amazed, or I was amazed that they were able to make that kind of a leap to that from that music, because they put it into these really interesting, now it sounds much more symphonic in a way, because you're not hearing the cues just separate, you know, because when you do a library, because I'm scoring to picture, but you're also thinking, well, after about so many shows, they're going to want to, the music editor's going to want to track some of these things. So I always tried to make the cues trackable.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with DuckTales. I mean, we only scored about 7 shows, and they got about 150 shows out of those, because you design it so that it doesn't have dead ends, so there's ways to go from one cue to another. You know, so it's interesting to listen to it, and I've gotten some emails from people that have already listened to it, and they're really amazed at the whole thing. But I really have to credit Lucas Kendall and the guys over there that were putting the package together for kind of doing those things.
Mm-hmm.